This is the Millennial Millionaire Through Real Estate podcast.
You know, I call myself a recovering perfectionist. So I was really like kind of running myself into the ground at the time. And, you know, I stopped and was like, what is this life? And I knew something had to change.
You're listening to the Millennial Millionaire Through Real Estate podcast, where we discuss tangible tips, tricks, and best practices for becoming financially free. The show is designed for people who want to either start real estate investing or for those who want to scale their real estate business.
What's up, guys? This is Jonathan Farber, host of the Millennial Millionaire Through Real Estate podcast. This show is all about achieving financial freedom as fast as possible so you can do whatever makes you happy in life. For me, that vehicle was real estate, and it's how I achieved financial freedom at 27. If you want to know how I got started, my journey is presented in a YouTube video posted in the show notes, and I post daily in our private Facebook group about my favorite topics and day-to-day strategies. I appreciate you guys being here, and let's get started. Oh, by the way, reach out if you ever need help. I try to keep my calendar open to talk to anyone that needs it or has any quick questions. See you guys. Talk to you later. This episode is sponsored by Infinite Road Destinations, the smartest short-term rental property management group I know, and the group that manages my properties. This is a company that's very close to my heart, run by two of the smartest, most attentive people I know, Claire Rosenberg and Alex Brashears. Claire and I first met when we worked together at NetApp, where she was a top performer and rose crazy fast in the company. And Alex is just one of the most active, genuine people I know in the real estate space. The two of them together bring a blended background of project management, software design, and extensive experience with automation tools and virtual assistants. Through these experiences, they optimize any property to deliver a hands-off experience to owners while delivering the highest occupancy and highest daily rates possible. You guys know I would not recommend anything to anyone in this group that I do not fully endorse or think that is the absolute best product. And this company is that. And like I said before, this is the exact company and people that manage my Airbnbs. If you don't believe me, here are a few of the other tools and services that come along with the team: listing optimization, guest support and approval, communication and reservations, key exchange and management, dynamic pricing, welcome kit creation, listing advertising and marketing, vendor management, including cleaners, maintenance, handyman, runners, and monthly property reports. To learn more, check out shorttermmadeeasy.com or email info@shorttermmadeeasy.com. And on the form, just mention that you heard it here or mention my name. So give it a try. You have nothing to lose, and they offer a satisfaction guarantee. And I assure you guys, you will not be disappointed. What's up, guys? Today we have an awesome episode with Amanda Cassaday. She is based in New York, former New York City resident, actually, but now lives in upstate New York in the Kingston area. And we get into that in the show about how she bought a second home up there that she does live in one part and Airbnb in the other, but just has a really cool story of how she was able to start real estate investing while living in a really expensive market where most people say it's not possible. And she was able to surely prove that it was possible. So she's done three deals in three different states. She has five units total spanning across Ohio, Tennessee, and New York. She still works her full-time job. And what I want to call out also is that she like openly admits she's not making a ton of money in her full-time job, so that it's not like she's doing this just like buying everything retail and just paying to get it done. Like, there are creative ways to get into these deals, which we talk about. And it's just cool to hear her story, how she started with a turnkey property. Then she did an out-of-state investment in Ohio. And then she bought this property in upstate New York, and like how she had a different use case for each of them and kind of just like how she thought through the financing for each of them. So really good stuff there. There were a couple really interesting learnings here. One, just how to learn about markets and neighborhoods from distance, like how she goes through step-by-step looking for emerging communities or areas that she thinks will have good tenants that will pay and be safe to drive around in at night. And the second thing that was a main learning from this episode was how she navigated a really brutal situation where a repair was done during her due diligence period. And it was done completely just like out of code and really just like poorly done. And she was able to go back to that seller and that contractor after she had a kind of nightmare of a plumbing problem. And they sent her a check for $20,000 to cover all the damages and expenses. And she kind of walks through step by step how she was able to make that happen when most people, I think, would just take the loss and have to come out of pocket and deal with that whole headache and expense themselves. So really interesting stuff. Listen for that. It's a great story. Today's tangible tip is if you see someone go live on Instagram specifically, request to join. Like, you have nothing to lose by requesting to join. And a lot of times they're waiting for a guest to come on who's maybe running a little bit late. And it's kind of a cool way for them to just pull people on and have conversations or ask questions. And it does a couple things. One, you start a relationship with that person. But two, people see that you're live with someone that might be like a bigger social media presence than you. And you might get a lot of followers from that. Or you might get kind of an awareness if you go on and ask a good question or just kind of have a good dialogue with that person. It just gets you more attention. So it's kind of like attention hacking or attention arbitrage, which is one of the best ways to grow if you can kind of latch on other people who are growing. So just really random one, but it's a good tangible tip. If you see someone go live, request to join. Also, they're typically probably happy to bring people on because they run out of stuff to talk about. We all do when we're doing live stuff. So it helps. So that's pretty much it, guys. That's today's tangible tip. Without any further ado, awesome episode today with Amanda Cassaday. All right, Amanda, what is going on? Welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Jonathan?
I'm doing pretty good. I feel like we have a lot in common, especially that we're both from New York originally, and then we both kind of did some migration during COVID, like a lot of people did. But I can't complain. Just trying to figure it out like everyone else and, doing deals and meeting cool people. But it's all good stuff. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about you and specifically even kind of your entry into real estate. Then I'm sure we'll talk about kind of this past year, what it's looked like. But if you wouldn't mind, from a high level, could you kind of give us a background on how you got into real estate and then also what you do today in real estate?
Yeah, sure, for sure. So my life and career has kind of zigged and zagged a bit, but when you start to think about the whys behind them, I think you can start to see the red thread as to why I became interested in real estate and why I'm interested in financial independence. So right after college, I actually joined the Peace Corps. I lived in West Africa for 3.5 years. 2 of those years was in a rural village with no electricity and running water. Third year was living in the capital of Senegal. All of those years I was earning about $8 a day, so had zero savings, but learned a lot. I actually tell people I grew up in West Africa because you just experience kind of the rawness of life and connect with so many incredible human beings. And there's a resourcefulness there that I think I picked up on and understood the value of coming out of that. So jumping from that to business school, because I learned there really the power of business for financial freedom. Business school had me take on, $75,000 in debt. I had zero savings. I was joining the workforce at about 28 years old, moving to New York City, where, I was earning a great salary for, the first salary I'd ever, earned as an adult. But what was so shocking to me was how much of my paycheck was going towards my living expenses. Almost half of it was being handed off to my landlord, the rest of it being handed off just to live, a daily life. And so I learned very quickly that I wanted to actually, own what I earned and learned that, okay, well, at the salary that I was making, I could at least start renting 2-bedroom apartments and rent out the second bedroom. Mm-hmm. So that gave me a little bit more control over how much I was spending month to month on rent. And obviously how much I was charging on rent. So that then turned into, I'll start Airbnb-ing the second bedroom in my apartment. And I did that for actually many years, became really profitable, helped me save a ton of money on rent year over year. And as I started to get more interested in this idea of passive income through real estate, and I started saving through, bonuses and salary and not paying as much on rent, that's when I got into actually purchasing property. So first one was a turnkey in 2017. That one, frankly, is a bit of a boring investment for people who really want passive income. I encourage it, but you won't get as much passive income if you do it that way versus, getting your hands a bit dirtier. And I'm the kind of person who likes to get my hands dirty. So, flex the muscle of putting a larger amount of money towards a thing that I own, and to, you know, to see that system of getting money in return on a monthly basis kind of helped spur me into more action. So next came my second property. And at this time, we can get into this a little bit later, I was working about 16-hour days. I had a really difficult boss. I was traveling a lot for work. And frankly, a lot of it was probably self-induced. You know, I call myself a recovering perfectionist. So I was really like kind of running myself into the ground at the time. And, you know, I stopped and was like, what is this life? And I knew something had to change. So, you know, I did some things in my career that we can talk about later, but that really helped recalibrate my focus and my values and how my actions align towards what I want to do in the future for myself. Mm-hmm. And that was when I was like, I need to start owning this real estate process myself. But I can't afford in New York City. I can't afford in DC, which is where I grew up. So I had to become an expert in, you know, a market that I hadn't been to. So I downloaded raw data from Zillow, which anyone can do, it's free. And I started analyzing rent and sales trends by city. And then I started to add other factors like unemployment, like crime, like migration patterns. And I started to hone in on the number of cities. Actually came, two of my top cities were both in Ohio. Began reaching out to people, found out I had kind of most connections within the Cincinnati area. Planned a visit, a friend decided they were interested too. He's now a great friend and business partner, my friend Jeff. Mm-hmm. And we went to Cincinnati, that's where we bought our first duplex together. Mm-hmm. So that was my second property. We can talk about that. That's actually pretty profitable. I'm getting a 20% cash on cash return from that. And it's appreciated about 50% just in the last 2 years.
Wow.
So that's, and there were ups and downs of that, for sure. There was a point where we lost, you know, $20,000, and then we were able to get it all back. So definitely learned a lot of lessons through that very first property that we did on our own. Mm-hmm. And then came the third property, definitely not the last property. And that happened in November of 2019. I closed on a property about 2 hours north of New York City. And I chose that area because I wanted to invest in something that I could actually take advantage of as well. As you and I may have in common, New York can get pretty exhausting. And the one thing that, you know, all people who live in New York for, you know, 10 years plus have in common is a house upstate. So I was looking upstate. I wanted a place that could still generate revenue, but also something that I could enjoy, which is a bit of a unicorn. But I found a two-family, definitely needed some renovation work. I wanted to get into the renovation space. Closed in November of 2019, finished renovating in March of last year. So right when COVID was really taking the biggest toll in New York City. And I actually never left. I ended up moving my stuff pretty quickly out of Brooklyn into this house in the Hudson Valley. And the unit that I renovated upstairs found tenants for quite quickly. And they have actually decided to stay for last year. That property is earning me, you know, after mortgage, after expenses, about $1,000 a month. And it's giving me a place to live and I'm not paying rent.
Got it. Okay. That's awesome. There's a lot there. So thank you for the high level. So like a lot of people living in New York might wonder their path to getting started. So where I want to kind of dig into that for you is you started with a turnkey, and for some people, they look back and say, I wish I wouldn't have done that. Some people say it was kind of something I needed to do to at least understand the process and just get started and go through a transaction. So for you, would you do it again? Or if you could go back in time, would you just maybe jump into the Midwest or upstate New York? Or do you feel like it was kind of that training wheel deal to get you in the game?
It's a good question. I mean, just looking at what I know now, what I've done and looking at my portfolio, it's the least profitable. I'd love to free up that cash and do something else with it, frankly. Mm-hmm. However, I do find that it might've been a bit of a necessary evil. Like I had to get used to putting, you know, at the time it was $16,000. That's, and I, remember, I was a, you know, former Peace Corps volunteer, you know, I wouldn't spend more than a dollar a day on food and all living expenses. So $17,000 was the most amount I've ever spent on anything in my entire life by leaps and bounds. So that was frightening, even though I was earning a good income. And so I think I just had to flex that muscle and begin to see the rewards, you know, come out of that on a month-to-month basis to then empower me to get more involved and embedded in the process.
Hmm. Okay, I like that. It just, it's a, different for everyone, but I think for some people, doing something is just better than doing nothing. So even if you're getting a deal that's even a personal residence, and maybe you can either house hack or do like an in-law suite or buy something turnkey, like it's moving the ball forward. I find if people don't get small wins or momentum in some direction, it's hard to stay motivated after maybe 6 months, unless you're just like a special type of person. But it's easy to fall off and just feel like this is too hard. I'm going to go back to just kind of being busy and maybe even unhappy, you know, like not worth making the trade-off. So like, I want small wins, but you know, there's a fine line between people that are using that as an excuse and actually just looking for a really good investment. So we don't have to talk about that too much because I think there's a lot of stuff out there on turnkey companies. We've had turnkey people on the show. We used to have a turnkey sponsor and, you know, just, it's an interesting model, but I think for people like us that are looking for more cash flow to maybe kind of replace our income or living expense, there are other options. So I would love to hear about the option, the property in Ohio, the duplex. As you know, you say that to people typically in New York or Long Island or wherever in the expensive cities. And they're like, how can you, you can't buy stuff out of state or, you know, that's not possible. So can you walk us through kind of maybe what it looked like from building a team to finding a deal to then kind of just like your thought process as you were going and looking for that?
Yeah, of course. And I think, because I've listened to a lot of podcasts about this, I think too, you can carve this out in a really regimented, disciplined and analytical way. I think that's important to an extent, but I also think that there's a level of intuitiveness that you can lean into, because I think a lot of this is about relationship building and that's kind of organic. You can't really force that. And so it's a bit of a push and pull between, you know, what the numbers say and kind of where the heat is moving relationally with the people that you connect with along the way. So with Ohio, it just started off with me. And I think at the time, it's funny, I was looking back at some of my work. At the time I was traveling a lot to and from Washington, DC and New York, visiting family. And so that was my time. I'd go in the cafe car, pull up my computer, and I'm just look at these massive Excel sheets and just start, you know, adding different metrics and filtering them and analyzing them however I could. So it was really in the beginning, just looking at numbers and not getting too connected to any one city. And then once I started to see, okay, well, you know, Cincinnati keeps coming up, and then I did a little bit more research, and then, you know, it popped up on some other trend reports, and it's like, okay, well, what are employers doing? Okay. I see like Facebook's coming in and some other, and okay. So now who do I know there? And so I started to reach out to my network, and it turned out that, you know, a really good friend of mine from college, you know, knew a guy who we know, Joe Fairless, who, you know, they used to work together, and he since moved from New York City to Cincinnati to start his real estate empire. Amazing. So I got to connect with him. He connected me with my agent who works with out-of-state real estate investors. You know, I began connecting with brokers. All of this was before I even stepped foot in Ohio. I'd actually never been to Ohio before this. So kind of starting to get things lined up, again, being personable, being human, to understand, do these people align with the approach I want to take, with the values that I have? You know, is there a feeling of, you know, I can trust you, you know, along this process? So planned a lot. You know, we planned to have a trip there. So my friend Jeff at this point was like, hey, let's do this. I want to jump in on this. Jeff and I had worked together at my company for several years. So, you know, we knew how we worked. We had a flow. There was already that trust there. And so, you know, I planned out what the trip would look like. We hopped on over and we basically did a tour where we connected with different lenders. We had a bunch of properties lined up with our agent, Slocum Reed. And you know, from there, we would just, every night we were doing a few things. We were running the numbers. So I built these Excel sheets that could crunch all the numbers so we could figure out if what we saw was actually profitable. But then we also wanted to get a lay of the land, right? Like I had looked zip code by zip code, you know, what rents and sales prices were, what, you know, crime looked like, what the schools looked like, but I hadn't actually been there. And so we just went to every neighborhood we could in the mornings and the evenings. We went into local shops. We talked to people. We want to understand, you know, where were the young people going? The strategy that we've taken and that I've taken since then is to really look at emergent neighborhoods and communities like C+, B-, that there's something there. There's like seeds of creativity and opportunity there. And you start to see the flood of young people kind of going and nurturing that creativity. And so, you know, that's how we tried to connect with people to see, you know, where was that within Cincinnati?
Mm-hmm.
And so that helped give us both like the analytical, but then also the kind of qualitative elements of the city and if it resonated with us. And so the neighborhood we ended up landing on was a place that was, you know, 15-minute drive from downtown that was like the hottest place for young people to be, but they were also being priced out. So we kind of looked at a tangential place that, you know, kind of seemed to, the prices were right, there was space, the homes were beautiful, but still had that access to where the young people were going.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a couple things. One, Slocum Reed is one of my closest friends in real estate, and he's just one of the nicest, most genuine people that I think I've ever met. So when this is not about me, but I feel like it's going to be funny, especially since you ended up investing there. When COVID hit, I moved to the Midwest for like 3 months. And I spent a couple weeks in Ohio, and I would just hang out with Slocum, and he like took me in, like just showed me around like Cincinnati, and we just looked at a lot of deals. So just really funny, you know, like over the Rhine and like just some of those like.
Did you get some skyline chili?
What's that?
Did you have some skyline chili?
No. What's that?
Oh, that's like the thing. It's like this really like. I don't know. I don't want to do it disservice, but it's kind of like the Taco Bell of chili, Midwestern style. And it's just, in every neighborhood, you see this big skyline chili restaurant, and they put it, I think they put it on pasta. They put it on, you know, chips. They put it on bread. They put it on everything. And it's shamelessly delicious.
I will have to call Slocum after this and tell him that he didn't give me the proper tour without the chili run. So that's hilarious. I love a couple of things you said there about like understanding neighborhoods, because that's the hardest part. I mean, from out of state, you can't drive it or you can't kind of like feel it. But I mean, in your case, you took a trip and you were able to kind of feel it out in a short period of time and get help from someone that was local. I love the part about driving, seeing it at different times in the day and kind of getting a feel for who's hanging out where young people are going and where kind of new development is going. Is there anything else on that? Just like for someone that's listening out there who kind of feels stuck on picking a neighborhood, maybe they have a city defined, like, okay, I want to look at Columbus, Ohio or Indy, but like, how do I know what's safe? How do I even know where to start? It's just so daunting and overwhelming, I think, for a lot of beginners. So any tips or any other stuff, tactics that you think about for someone that feels stuck on finding a neighborhood within a city?
Yeah, I mean, if you just want one simple metric to look at schools. Schools are like the number one thing that people go for. If you want to make sure your place isn't vacant, doesn't stay vacant, you want a place with really good schools, because at the end of the day, like, people will move to neighborhoods just to have their kids go to good schools. And I think it also guarantees, you know, a kind of tenant who, you know, if they value education, I'm sure that they value, you know, your property as well. So that's one thing. Crime, I believe I looked on, I think it was Realtor. They have these like crime ratings. So that was kind of an easy metric that I could find in most neighborhoods to see, like, is it something I should watch out for, something I shouldn't. But honestly, another thing is talking to agents. Like, Slocum was amazing. He could talk about every single neighborhood in the community. And so if you have an agent that is friendly and trustworthy and just like a great human being, you know, you can trust on them to say like, hey, you know, this area is up and coming, is what you're looking for. This area, I'd watch out for crime. Another person to think about resourcing, and we're doing this now because we're looking to invest more at a bigger scale in Cincinnati, is talk to your property manager, because ultimately they're the one managing the property. they're going to be the ones that has to deal with it day in and day out. And so they can tell you with a lot more certainty, like, I wouldn't go here, you know, you're going to have a lot of extra costs around just maintenance and upkeep because of the crime versus some other areas.
Just a couple questions on that, because I think it's so important. One, how did you find your property manager? And then two, how hands-on or off were they in your process? Like, could you send them a deal, or were you sending, did you have like a sequence? Would Slocum send it to you? Then you'd send it to a property manager. Did he introduce you to the property manager? Again, like, these are the common out-of-state investor questions, but clearly you found a way to overcome it.
It's a good question. And you kind of, it's like, you know, we didn't have our whole team set up in the very beginning, and we were okay with that because we kind of wanted to be fully immersed in the process. And it's a bit harder that way, and you make more mistakes because you're not an expert in it, but you learn really, really fast. And so what we did is we had Slocum. He was amazing. We actually decided in the very beginning to go with a company called Hemlane, and they're basically an online property management coordinator. So you can, all of your rents go through Hemlane. It's super easy to kind of blast advertisements for a rental space available on a bunch of different platforms through Hemlane. But then also, if there's a maintenance request, you can kind of the tenant can upload requests through Hemlane, and then the coordinator will kind of manage all of that. So if a property is pretty easy from a maintenance perspective, Hemlane is amazing. They were also very new at the time, so I think they were working on a few kinks. We had quite a fiasco in our first year of owning the property, and it required a lot of hands-on management that, you know, Hemlane was super helpful, and the CEO even stepped in and helped us hands-on. It was amazing. And wow. I think through that process, we realized we wanted, you know, a human just to make sure there was someone there close in proximity, you know, who had a few more relationships locally of suppliers and could have that direct kind of human interaction with our tenants. So the woman who came in was actually referred by Hemlane to show our property, and she was great. And it was like, hey, you're really good at this. Do you manage properties? And she said, yeah, I do. And so, you know, from there, we've been working together really closely. So how it's working now is we're looking at new properties is, yeah, Slocum and his team will send us over some properties. We'll run some numbers. If it's something we're interested in, we'll pass it over to our property manager and say, hey, what do you think? And get our thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And I guess just down that path, I'm sort of familiar with Hemlane, but like in that case, was it an option presented to you that you could manage it yourself, but you just had some good technology to kind of like help with it, or were they still connecting you with a property manager? And I guess, do you have a preference?
Yeah, I think, so this was at the time, I don't know if they've changed their services since, but we had two options. One where we just kind of utilize the platform because it's a great way to centralize all communication, all rent was done through digital deposit. All property listings was done through Hemlane. So it's just like a nice, simple, you know, coordinated platform in that regard. And then the other option was to have, you know, the whole maintenance team, which was kind of this back-end team who kind of would serve to manage maintenance requests. And then they would actually go out and find local providers and kind of coordinate their dispatching and everything else. And then we could actually say, hey, you're welcome to charge at will up to $200, for example. But if it's more than that, give us a call and we can be the decision makers there. So those were the options because we did want kind of a human property manager nearby. We decided to use this scaled down version of Hemlane. So everything is still kind of centralized and coordinated on the platform. And then our property manager is the one really kind of syncing up with providers and dealing directly with the tenants.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was that the deal? You said that there was potentially a big expense, 20,000. Okay. So do you mind just actually explaining or telling us what that was? I usually ask something around like, what was your biggest challenge? Had you overcome it type of thing? So it sounds like that might be in the running for what that was.
Oh yeah. 100%. So it was a great like education. I felt like I earned 5 years of real estate investing in that one year. So So we found this property. The inspector said it was the best 100-year-old house he'd ever seen. So it got a great review from an inspection perspective. The one thing he couldn't prove out were the quality of the pipes underground. And in the Midwest, when you get 100-year-old houses or older, a lot of the pipes are actually clay. And so when you get, you know, overgrown shrubs, bushes, trees, you know, roots can more easily penetrate the clay pipes, and there can be a lot more challenges just from a drainage perspective. So, you know, we thought we were really clever at the time and said, okay, well, we'll pay a little bit more. We'll hire a plumber to scope the pipes as a part of our due diligence period. The plumber did find that part of the clay pipes had been broken as a result of tree roots and needed to be replaced. And so what we said is, contingent upon purchasing the property, the seller has to repair this line of pipe to ensure everything between the pipe, the house, and the main line were in good condition. In hindsight, that was our first mistake. Never ask a seller to do the work, just negotiate down the price of the house and do the work yourself. Because at the end of the day, a seller is motivated to spend as little money as possible to make as much money as possible. So the seller ended up using the same plumber to replace the pipes. That plumber ended up doing the work not only negligently, but he didn't have an inspector come out and inspect the property and inspect the work. And so, gosh, about 8 months later, I got a video from my tenants saying that with sewage just falling from the ceiling, from the upper unit to the lower unit. And it caused thousands of dollars of damage and obviously created some really unhappy tenants. We fixed the problem only for a month later for it to happen again. And so we didn't know that the job had been done poorly. We didn't know what the issue was. And so we brought in another plumber. The plumber that we brought in suspected that there was something wrong with that piece of pipe that had been installed 8 months earlier.
Wow.
And so what we would have to do is break ground and completely replace that pipe. So when you include all the work that had to be done, when you include all of the repairs to the house, when you include lost rent, because, you know, we couldn't promise our tenants when this would be fixed, and it was not a sanitary place to live. And so, you know, we let them both break the lease without penalty. When you include all that, we were down about $20,000. Meanwhile, and at that point, it's like, it's a sunk cost, you know, like, and we were really hard on ourselves. I was very hard on myself. You know, it was like our first time investing, and, you know, I would encourage people to try not to get so down. These things happen, and like, nothing is permanent, right? Things are always changing. And so we decided, look, it's already a sunk cost. Let's do whatever we can within reason to try to get this money back, because there is an issue of negligence here. So I did a few different things to try to get the money back, by talking to the plumber, to writing negative reviews. You know, he was insured and bonded, so because of that, that should have covered his negligence, but he wasn't willing to access those resources to reimburse us. And so that's when we did get a lawyer involved, and we wrote both letters to the plumber and to the seller, because the seller is partially at fault too. And we actually ended up getting all of the money back.
Wow. Just in a check? In
a check. One day in the mail, we got a check for $20,000.
Wow.
So we actually made money from that, because we had already used our insurance to cover the damage. And they gave us way more than we needed to make the repairs. Plus, we got a check in the mail. So it actually turned out to be one of our best performing years ever. Unfortunately, not for the greatest of reasons. But again, that's just to show nothing is permanent. And you know, do what you can. You know, at the very worst, it was going to be, you know, an education, a really great education for us. And it turned out to be better than that.
Wow. And ultimately, your main learning from that was to do the work yourself, or to inspect the work that was done? Like, what would you do if you could take the time machine back?
Yeah, I would definitely just negotiate down the house versus having the seller do the work. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, you know, we weren't on site, you know, because we were remote. So yeah, I would make sure that the plumber had, you know, an inspector come out and oversee the work. I'd want document everything. Because you just want to make sure you have your bases covered. We ended up working with Roto-Rooters and they were amazing. And they were taking pictures of everything along the way and showing it to me. They didn't have to do that, but it gave me a sense of certainty and trust. They let me know when the inspector came, they showed me the approvals. And so I definitely encourage folks to do that with mm-hmm. every kind of major service they get done on their house.
Got it. That's really important. That's really cool. Anything else on that deal? There's so much to learn from that, but anything else on that deal that you would just tell a beginner to think about it or look out for? Any just main learnings you had from that deal before we go into the next one?
That is the biggest. I would also say I'm a big fan of duplexes in general. The turnkey was a single family. I am focusing on duplexes or higher these days. And I think it's just because you're hedging a bit. So for example, one of the units was vacant for a little while, but the bottom unit covered our entire mortgage and we were still cash flowing by a few hundred bucks a month. So, you know, make sure when you do buy a property, you have some contingency plans if, you know, it doesn't always go the way you want.
That's really good advice. Okay, awesome. So I'd love to talk about the next deal, the one that you bought in upstate New York. Kind of if you could run through the same thing of how you found it, how you funded it. Actually, sorry, I don't know if we talked about that on the Ohio property. Was there anything interesting worth noting on like the financing or the way that you funded that deal? Or was it just a 20% investment or 25% investment? Yeah.
We bought it as an LLC. And so it was a 20-year loan, 20% down. Nothing super special about it. My partner and I shared the down payment. So it was a very easy amount of money to put down. It was a $100,000 property. We each put down 10 grand. And it's appreciated to about probably 150 or so. So we're looking to refinance and use. So it's like that little bit of money we put in is turning into a much bigger pot of money that we can reinvest.
Gotcha. I mean, we'll go into this, I guess, now with the latest deal, but like knowing that, is that an area that you plan to keep investing in and like keep looking for deals, or are you now more kind of on this part? Like, how do you think about like where your focus is deal wise?
Yeah, I definitely want to stay in Cincinnati. We're actually talking to my friend and partner, Jeff. We are talking to two different sets of people, and I'm actually talking to a third about potential partnerships for larger scale properties. And so Cincinnati is definitely one of those places. But then the other is the Hudson Valley, because I've, you know, not only have I fallen in love with the area, but it's definitely been growing a lot in popularity, especially, you know, post-COVID. And I've been building partnerships here to actually get stuff up and off the ground, you know, beyond just myself. So, you know, we can talk about that, but yeah, I think both Hudson Valley and Cincinnati are kind of my focus areas. I think there's better to build scale within a few places than kind of scatter across, you know, a bunch of areas. Cause at least for me, frankly, like there's an economies of skill, knowledge, relationships you can gain in specific areas.
Yeah. I think the relationships is so important. Just having people that you know and trust is, if not equally as important, if not more important than just looking for good returns. You can find good returns, but the people help you get those returns and save money. So it's so important. So I would love to just hear about the New York deal, how you found it, financed it, you know, what your business plan with it was, all that.
Yeah. So I looked in a very traditional way, you know, through the MLS with an agent. It was a hot market, but not as hot as it's become. So I spent most of the summer coming up. I think it was a lot of figuring out what town within the Hudson Valley did I want to stay in. You know, you have some that are much more in the mountains, more remote, very peaceful, but a little less accessible. And then you had others that were, you know, larger towns, more accessible, but not as much nature. And so, you know, this was a bit more of a personal choice for me because it was a place I wanted to go to and enjoy. So I was including factors like how, you know, I didn't have a car at the time, how easy would it be to get up there? You know, are there enough things for me to do? You know, what's going to be the cost of maintenance? Is there going to be things like septic, et cetera, that I would need to kind of pay attention to that maybe I wouldn't care as much if I were an out-of-state investor, but because it would be something I'd be going to be visiting and probably managing a bit more myself, you know, I cared a bit more about. I landed on a town that is, you know, a bit bigger. It's a hub to a lot of other smaller towns, to nature, but there's also something, and it's similar to Cincinnati. I think this is really important, you know, at least for me and my approach to investing is there was a really strong creative community here, and it was just becoming stronger and larger. And I think when you have that kind of energy within a city, it's very magnetic. And that is a sure sign that it will continue to grow and flourish and gain momentum, not just from a prosperity and economic perspective, but also from a home value perspective and what's likely to kind of continue to grow in demand. So wow. Landed on this place, I found a duplex. And what was interesting was that apparently I was not the first one to put an offer on it. Apparently there were several other offers. I don't know if it was a game that the agent was playing or not, but you know, I was told that there were two other offers on the house and what was my offer. I only, based on advice from my agent, I only put an offer of 5K more than the selling price. But what I added is that I would keep the tenant in the lower unit. And that was advice from my agent. I think we got the sense that, you know, that tenant had been there for a long time. I think there was a relationship between the tenant and the seller. And evictions are messy, right? People don't like evictions. And so I'm sure the seller didn't want to deal with that. And my offer ended up getting accepted. So that was, I signed November 2019. Then I began looking for contractors. I connected to, there's a lot of Airbnb forums on Facebook. So I reached out, ended up connecting with folks who put me in touch with my now contractors. And we just got on really well. They gave me an estimate. We decided to start January 1st. And what I said was, there was a caveat. And the caveat was, I had to be involved. They had to let me do the work alongside them because I wanted to learn. A harder commitment to make on my end, but it was something I was really passionate about and I wanted to understand. So at the time they were only working weekends. So I would work 5 days a week and then I would drive up every weekend from January through early March to work with them alongside. And, you know, as again, we talk about relationships. I built some incredible relationships with them. I mean, the foreman is like a second father to me. And, you know, we hope to go into business together down the road and start to do, you know, more investments ourselves. So, you know, it was an investment more in just the property, but in, you know, a future of doing business together. So, you know, and at the same time, COVID was beginning to get bad. I mean, we were refinishing the floors and couldn't buy face masks at Home Depot at that point. So it was scary. I wasn't sure what to do. I wasn't sure where to live. I wasn't sure if Airbnb would be profitable. And then at the same time, I was struggling with the tenant in the lower unit who was breaking the lease that we had set up and smoking, you know, inside the house. And so basically what had happened was, you know, move forward with the eviction. And I can talk about that if you're curious, but you know, tenant willingly moved out within 30 days. I ended up moving into the downstairs unit and began listing the upstairs unit that had been fully furnished and renovated, and got, you know, an amazing couple to move up there. It was originally a 3-month lease, again, on short-term rental prices, which was fairly high compared to your average monthly rental. And they keep extending. So they've been on the property for almost a year now. And their rent alone covers mortgage, covers expenses, and still earns me about $1,000 a month.
Man, I hate to cut this. I feel like we might need to do a part two just because there's so much good stuff here and there's so much like interesting parts of your story that people can learn from. But just for the sake of time, I think we do have to tie off there, but that is just an interesting kind of like place to leave as a teaser. We might need to set up a part two. Regardless, if people wanted to reach out or follow the story and kind of get in touch, what would be the best way for people to do that?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's Amanda Cassaday. My last name is Cassaday. AmandaCassaday.com. You can find my Instagram, my LinkedIn. You can email me there. So that's probably the best way to get in touch.
Okay, awesome. Amanda, thank you so much. I just want to say it's really cool to connect with other New Yorkers and people that have just kind of kept moving through this and not let it stop them. So appreciate you coming on and best of luck in 2021.
Such a pleasure. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
All right, Amanda. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, you millennial millionaire. Are you looking for help getting to the next level in real estate? Are you looking for accountability and strategy to achieve your goals? If so, Jonathan is now taking on one-on-one students and opening a few spots in his private mastermind. It's affordable and welcome to everyone. If you had any questions or think you may need a boost, send Jonathan a message on Facebook or email at johnjfarber@outlook.com.